It's the takeaway for May 15th. As President Trump pushes for friendly relations with Russia, administration officials are taking a measured approach.
We have differences. Each country will protect its own interests, look out for its own interests of its people. But it's not destined that we're adversaries on every issue.
Also on the show, a woman who works with victims of domestic violence in Honduras shares her story.
The last time I saw her, she said, "Freedom never smelled so good." And I never knew there was a smell to freedom.
And why one cartoon wedding is such a big deal.
This is a wonderful reality that is really not being shown to kids who could benefit hugely from knowing, you know, if this is something that's true for them, that they have a future where they can be happy.
All right, folks, let's make it happen.
I'm here today because President Trump is committed to improving this relationship.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo traveled to Sochi, Russia on Tuesday. And it was there where he met with the country's President Vladimir Putin and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov.
We have differences. Each country will protect its own interests, look out for its own interests of its people. But it's not destined that we're adversaries on every issue.
That may be true, but Tuesday's meeting also focused on tensions that exist between Russia and the U.S., and those include relations with Venezuela and Iran.
On Venezuela, we have disagreement.
The Secretary of State also said he warned Russian officials about interfering in the upcoming U.S. elections, a topic President Trump declined to touch when he spoke to Vladimir Putin earlier this month.
We didn't discuss that. Really, we didn't discuss it. We discussed five or six things.
To be clear, top intelligence officials under both Trump and Barack Obama have agreed that the Russian government did attempt to influence the 2016 election, and that the country has continued those interference efforts in the years since. Now, the State Department appears to be on the same page as U.S. intelligence leaders.
And we spoke, too, about the question of interference in our domestic affairs. I convened that there are things that Russia can do to demonstrate that these types of activities are a thing of the past. And I hope that Russia will take advantage of those opportunities.
Even as the president remains focused on improving relations with Russia.
We intend to do a lot of trade with Russia. We do some right now. It's up a little bit. But he'd like to do trade, and we'd like to do trade. And getting along with Russia and China, getting along with all of them is a very good thing. Not a bad thing. It's a good thing. It's a positive thing.
So here's the issue. If the president is saying one thing about Russia and Pompeo is saying another, that could lead to muddy foreign policy with a country that has repeatedly tried to influence our elections. And we're going to talk it over. We turn now to the current state of U.S.-Russia affairs with Kimberly Martin, professor of political science at Columbia University's Barnard College. Kimberly, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Tanzina. Good to be here.
So let's get started because I have many questions. First of all, are we friends with Russia? Or is it just the president who's friends with Russia? What did this latest visit tell us about how different the president's relationship is with Russia versus our own administration?
That's such a good question, and it's really hard to answer. But I think the most important thing to take away from this visit is that there are areas where it's important that we cooperate with Russia, and that especially is true on arms control questions. We've got some important treaties that are under threat. But certainly there are so many areas where we are adversaries with Russia, and Russia shows no signs of changing.
So one of the things that keeps coming up here is the fact that Russia did interfere in our election. We know that they interfered.
Yes.
And why are we even still debating this? I mean, why didn't the president bring this up in his conversation with Putin? Why is Pompeo taking the stance that he took?
Well, I think Pompeo is taking the correct stance to take, which is that we know that you intervened in 2016, and we are worried about you intervening in 2020, and don't do it. And the problem, of course, is that President Trump isn't able to accept the facts that there was intervention, and that there is ongoing attempts at intervention, and that Russia isn't just picking on the United States, but that Russia has also intervened in the elections in Europe and in other places around the world, including, of all places, Madagascar.
And we've heard, you know, we hear Pompeo say that in the clip we had earlier in the show, he said, "I hope Russia will take advantage of those opportunities to not interfere in our election." That sounds quite generous. What happens if Russia doesn't take advantage of these quote-unquote opportunities.
It's just going to make the relationship very much worse. But, you know, there are limits on how the United States can react to what Russia does in a hostile fashion. We can keep on ramping up the sanctions, but at some point there's a limit to what can be done because there just isn't that much of an economic relationship between the United States and Russia. And, I mean, we could take, you know, the all-out step of trying to remove them from the SWIFT banking system, but that would destroy the Russian economy and hurt ordinary Russian people as much as it hurt the elites. And so I don't think anybody wants to do that unless things get very much worse. And so, I mean, really, there's the best step that the U.S. can take is to defend itself from election interference, because there's not that much we can do to harm Russia without really ramping up the conflict.
There have been a lot of conversations in recent weeks about the Trump administration and increasing tensions with Iran. We've talked that on this show. Let's talk about Russia and Iran at the moment. How closely aligned are they?
Well, they certainly have a very strong incentive in presenting themselves as being aligned so that they can challenge the United States. Both of them are in favor of the idea that we should be in a multipolar system in the world, which just means that the two of them can do more independently without worrying about the U.S. reaction. But the truth is, when we get down to the details, there are real problems in Syria, for example. Russia is angry at the role that Hezbollah and that Iran is taking in Syria in some ways. And so even though technically they're aligned with each other, there's some real conflicts emerging. And it would be good if U.S. diplomacy were actually nuanced enough that we could work on those differences and try to push them apart instead of lumping them into the same category.
How much of a focus was Iran in Tuesday's meeting? Do we know?
We don't know. All we know is what the public statements were. And I would guess that probably it was not the major focus. I think the major focus is probably Venezuela from what we've heard. But it's interesting that on the Russian side, they're just talking about the good points of the meeting. That's what the Russian press has been focusing on.
Speaking of Venezuela, we know that the at least the quote-unquote attempted coup with Juan Guaido has not been successful so far. U.S.-Russia are very much at odds when it comes to Venezuela. What happened in this meeting that we know about the country?
All we know is that they continued to express the fact that they're on opposite sides of this question. And I think the major question that we have to look at when we're looking at the Russian presence in Venezuela is what they're doing there. It could be to actually try to prevent the U.S. From taking any military action by fighting on behalf of Venezuela. But it also could just be Putin trying to say he wants a seat at the table in whatever kind of negotiation happens for a transition to a Guaido regime. And it's possible that that's just, Russia wanting to retain a presence rather than actually threatening the United States. We'll have to see what happens.
I'm speaking with political science professor Kimberly Martin about Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's recent visit to Russia. Kim, in a phone call with Vladimir Putin on May 3rd, President Trump said that they discussed how the U.S. and Russia could work together. He did not ask him about the election interference, which I'm still not sure why, but what do you make of the president's description of this call about foreign policy moving forward?
Good luck with that. I mean, there's so many basic interests that the U.S. and Russia do not have in common. Basically, Russia wants a stronger role in the world, and Russia does not fundamentally agree with the notion that the world should be moving in a direction of having more open relations and more democracy. Of course, we don't really know what direction Trump is moving either. So maybe Trump has an idea in his head that he's moving closer to Putin. But it doesn't look like Trump's advisors are going to allow him to do that, because they always push back and go in a more normal direction that we would expect of U.S. foreign policy.
But does the president's informal, if you will, or close relationship, if you will, with Vladimir Putin undermine the administration's efforts to do all the things that you're laying out?
You know, when push comes to shove, we have not seen all that much actual cooperative action between the U.S. and Russia. And so it's not actually clear that all the statements that President Trump has made over the years have had that much of an effect on the policy choices that the U.S. is making. We still have really strong sanctions against Russia, and nobody is talking about lifting them except maybe President Trump, and he doesn't seem to be taking actions to do so.
Well, let's talk about those sanctions. Okay. What are the sanctions that we have against Russia?
Oh, they've gone through waves. And so some of the sanctions are against developments in the oil and gas industry to try to prevent U.S. banks, for example, from giving loans to keep U.S. And European businesses from cooperating in what's called tight oil and gas, the stuff that's more difficult to get that takes advanced technology. Some of it is directed against particularly wealthy individuals who are associated with Putin's regime. What we've tried to do, I think, is avoid consumer goods to try not to have the effects be directed at the Russian people. But the sanctions have you know, over the years gotten stronger and stronger, and there's no sign that they're going away.
There is a the Trump administration earlier this year said that it would withdraw from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Big name. How important is that treaty?
Well, it's important mostly for its historical value and for what it did back in the 1980s. It was the first treaty that established what are called on-site inspections that allowed intelligence officers on both sides to go look at what was happening on the ground. And it meant that for the first time in history, we were no longer just relying on satellite overflights to understand what the other side was doing. So we could actually eliminate an entire class of missiles and have confidence that the other side was actually following the rules. Now, what's happened is that since 2014, we know that Russia has not been following the rules, that they've developed this new missile. Once the United States started accusing Russia of that, Russia started accusing the United States of doing something similar with the missiles that it has in its ballistic missile defense systems that are located in Poland and Romania. And so it's gotten kind of technical and kind of complicated. But an underlying factor that is influencing everything is that China is not part of the existing agreement, and China has new INF missiles that affect both Russia and the United States.
We've got about a minute left. Okay. I'm wondering if it's possible to create a new nuclear deal with Russia and China, as the president might be thinking about.
Unlikely, because China has no incentive to cooperate. Right now, China can threaten Russia, and China can threaten any U.S. Navy ship that comes near Chinese waters with these intermediate-range nuclear missiles. And why would China want to give that up? It's not clear.
And we're also going back and forth with China on trade, so this is an interesting time for us. Kimberly Martin is professor of political science at Columbia University's Barnard College. Thank you so much, Kimberly.
Thank you, Tanzina.
The number of people fleeing Honduras due to gang violence and political instability is on the rise. Between October and April, 96,000 people, or 20% of those detained at the U.S. southern border, were from Honduras. But women are especially vulnerable in the country. And in fact, Honduras is one of the most dangerous countries in the world for women. Gracie Murphy is determined to help.
We work to rescue women and children, victims of vulnerable groups, from violence in Honduras.
Gracie is the president of the Heart of Christ Justice Project in Honduras and author of a new book, Journey to Justice. In 2005, Gracie moved to Honduras with her husband for mission work. She decided to stay, and for years she's been working with authorities to help women and children escape violent circumstances. Now she runs an independent refuge center in the country, providing resources to women and children in need. And it's in that work that she's faced risks to her own life. I spoke with Gracie about her work, and note that there are details in this interview that some listeners may find disturbing. First, I asked Gracie if she's seen a shift in violence against women since she first arrived in 2005.
Violence has gotten much worse. When we arrived, a woman was murdered in Honduras every 2 days or every 3 days. It was about 185 cases a year. Over the last 14 years, more than 6,000 women have been murdered. And some years it's been in the 600s and 700s.
What is driving this abuse and violence?
It's the machismo attitude in Honduras that a woman is a man's property, and it's until death do you part. He could go off and have other girlfriends, or he could leave her and go be with another woman or throw her away, but she still always remains his. And then with the increase of drug trafficking and the increase of gang violence, drug traffickers and members of gangs act, it's like machismo on steroids. It's totally insane and out of control.
So machismo is sexism, essentially, mm-hmm. right? And no, it's not to say that every Honduran man is a machista either, right?
No.
I mean, there are pockets of progressive thought, I'm imagining, yes?
Yes, there are. It's mostly with the gang violence and with the drug violence that's going on that you see the extreme cases. But the belief, even in the churches, There are pastors who tell women they must endure the violence of their husband or they will be breaking up the family.
Is there a story that really stands out to you of a woman that you've helped?
Yes, there's a story that I include in my book. Her name was Gloria, and she told me to tell her story to the world. Her sister had come into our office in the police station and told us that Gloria had suffered 18 years of abuse at the hands of her husband and that their 16-year-old daughter, he had raped her also. She was in hiding, and they needed help. We got a team of investigators and police officers, and the sister took us to where she was. It was a small little adobe shack with a tin roof on the side of a hill, and she was completely shut in. We went in to speak with her. She wouldn't let us in at first. She was terrified. She was terrified if she let us in, she would die. But when we got in there and began talking to her, she told us she had gone to the police many times and they didn't help her, and that her husband liked to torture her by cutting the muscles in her legs. And he had carved his name in her back twice with a machete so no other man would have him. And she turned around and lifted her shirt and showed us his name in her back. She could barely walk. She was on crutches. And finally, we were able to convince her that this was before we had our refuge. And we didn't know of any refuges in Honduras at that time. We got a missionary friend to keep her while we did the investigation. He was actually my first death threat when he was arrested. He threatened to murder me from the jail cell. He said, when I get out, you're going to die, gringa. And he did go to court, and he did go to prison. When she was free, I remember the last time I saw her, she said, freedom never smelled so good. And I never knew there was a smell to freedom. But I guess for her, there was. And gets emotional with this story, remembering holding her in my arms as she cried, and she wouldn't come out. Yeah, that was just one of the most amazing stories.
You mentioned a refuge. Mm-hmm. What does the refuge look like? What is it today?
We have rooms in our facilities where we house women and children at any time of the day or night. The police, the investigators, the prosecutors will show up with or without warning. Sometimes they just show up and beep. They'll bring us women. They'll bring us children. They'll bring us women with children who are in the moment of violence. And we'll care for them and pray with them, provide the things that they need. We'll walk them through the legal process, go with them to the forensic evaluation, go with them to court, and try to help them find a better life after court is over.
You are seeing our southern border policy right now playing out, particularly with migrants from Central America. What do you tell the women, if anything, at all that you work with? Do you advise them not to come because of what you're seeing on the ground here? What do you tell them about what's happening?
We're trying to make it better for them to stay there and not have to come here. That's our ultimate goal. I don't want them on those roads. I know what happens to them on those roads, and it's dangerous. And I'm afraid that our government's not helping them when they should be helping them. And I understand it's overwhelming right now, and it's a big job. It's a huge job. This is a very complicated situation. And the government, there's some people in the Honduran government who want to do good, and they're my heroes. My book is dedicated to them and others who fight for justice around the world. But then there are some that are not, who are corrupt, and it's a difficult situation. So we win where we can win, and we try to make it better where we can, and we try to teach the Hondurans to stand up and take their cities back and to take their neighborhoods back and to make it so that they can stay. Why should anyone have to flee their home? Why should anyone have to flee their home? To leave your home for a choice is one thing, but to be forced to flee and leave your family and worry every day that your family may die because you left. Because they go after the families. If a gang is members related to the case, they'll go after the families.
Lots of things to think about. Gracie Murfree is president of the HOC Justice Project and the author of a new book, Journey to Justice. Gracie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi,
Hi, everybody. We need your help if you like this podcast. Make sure you subscribe if you're not already getting us every day. And tell your friends. Plus, leave us a rating and review on iTunes. It really helps us in a big way, and it helps other people find us.
Every day when you're walking down the street, everybody that you meet has an original point of view.
That's the theme song for everyone's favorite aardvark, Arthur. The long-running PBS cartoon, which is co-produced by The Takeaway's partner WGBH, recently premiered the first episode of its 22nd season, and it featured a very noteworthy wedding. In the show, Arthur's teacher, Mr. Ratburn, got married to his partner, Patrick, marking the first time the show has represented the LGBTQ community. But Arthur is just the latest example of the many children's programs that are now incorporating LGBTQ storylines and characters.
I know this is all kind of silly. I mean, we've been together for 5,750 years.
And 8 months.
I used to feel like I wasn't much good, just one of me on my own. But when we're together, it feels like it's okay to just be me. So I want to be me with you. And not even the diamonds will come between us. And if they try, we'll beat them up!
That's Ruby reading her wedding vows to Sapphire on the Cartoon Network show Steven Universe. The scene marked the first same-sex marriage depicted in a mainstream children's television show. Steven Universe has been praised for its LGBTQ representation and recently became the first animated show to win a GLAAD award. Rebecca Sugar is the creator of Steven Universe and is here to talk about LGBTQ representation in children's entertainment. Rebecca, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So tell us about why LGBTQ representation was important to bring that into Steven Universe.
Well, when I started the show, I really based it off of my relationship with my younger brother, Steven Sugar. And the show was really built around our sibling dynamic. But the fact of the matter is that Steven's older sibling is me, and I am bisexual. And part of our childhood growing up together, part of our friendship together, I'm a part of that. So my goal initially was to tell a very honest story through the lens of sci-fi, fantasy, action, comedy, really at its core, a very honest story about what it was like for us growing up together and being siblings and best friends. And that was part of that story. I couldn't leave that part out. It just wouldn't have been honest.
And what was the feedback? We know, as we mentioned at the top, the show has won a GLAAD award, but what's the feedback been like from kids who watch the show?
Oh, it's wonderful. The fans have been so amazing to get to see this generation and meet kids and their parents. Like when I go to conventions, to see them talking with each other, to see them bonding over the show, and to have this be a part of that conversation that parents and kids can have, and to also feel understood as a person. For so much of my life, I never talked about this. I would incorporate it into my work, into my cartoons. That was really how I expressed myself. But when I was growing up, personally, I was very shy, and I didn't really know that people would understand if I talked about this personally. And now all of a sudden I meet absolute, like complete strangers, and I meet, you know, teens and youth and families that completely understand and that completely relate. And I didn't know that so many people could relate to this because I hadn't really had an opportunity to talk about it. And so the show, in a way, is my chance to talk about this side of myself and know that it's okay to talk about this. It's been really life-changing for me to get to be open about this.
We know that back in 2005, PBS said they would not air an episode of an Arthur spinoff, which was called Postcards from Buster, because that spinoff featured a lesbian couple. I'm wondering, in your experience, how much you think network executives have evolved when it comes to LGBTQ characters since then, especially when we're talking about children's programming.
Right. Well, what's really so moving about this happening now in Arthur is that PBS did do this in 2005. They did show in Postcards from Buster, they did show this family, this real family. They made this episode, and then they were pressured by the Bush administration to pull it. And in 2005, I was a senior in high school, and I knew about this. At that point, I already knew I wanted to go into animation. And I heard all about this, and it's really difficult. I think it was really harmful to a lot of kids, anyone who was aware of this, anyone who was aware of that pressure. It's just really hurtful. And at the time when we first introduced Ruby and Sapphire as a couple, gay marriage was not yet legal in the United States. And we could not say that they were a romantic couple, which they absolutely were. We had to find a completely different way to talk about relationships in order to show what their relationship was. And over time, we pushed to have them be openly, romantically together. Although it was clear that they always were, that pushback over time, we got the executives on board with supporting what we were trying to do. And by 2016, we were able to do the wedding. It was really difficult for me personally. I could feel the difference between, there were aspects of, you know, my childhood that I could talk about openly. As a bisexual person, I could talk about the sort of heteronormative feelings that I had had, but I could not talk about this. And knowing that I had to hide that part of myself in something that was so much about my personal life, I felt awful. I felt like I had to be a liar, like I couldn't be honest. And I think it's so unfair because the children who internalize that, who see this and know that this has been taken out, then, you know, it's not fair that certain people get to be honest and other people just aren't allowed to be honest. And knowing that that by not including that that's what we were saying was very difficult for me. I couldn't stand to say that. I wanted to let kids know that that could be a part of their experience of growing up. And I think if you wait to tell kids that can be a part of their life and that those feelings, any sort of love feelings that they have, that those are beautiful, natural feelings, if you wait until they're already grown to tell them that, because it's not something that we're supposed to talk about with kids, you grow up feeling like you shouldn't exist and like there's, you don't get to understand your own feelings. And it's just very difficult. And I couldn't stand that. I wanted to get to be honest, and I wanted to tell our audience that they should get to be honest too.
You know, Rebecca, one of the things that I saw on social media after this happened was some folks were saying, well, why don't we just get to the point where it's not a big deal even, you know, like where this isn't an issue. It's not a segment on a show, for example. It's just part of a natural occurrence of the life of our animated characters here. Going forward, what do you think is important for children's shows in terms of LGBTQ representation?
Well, that would be amazing, and there just needs to be so much more of it. And we take for granted how often we tell love stories to kids, how often we show animated weddings. If there are many, many, many more of these, then yes, we could be there where this is as natural and beautiful and as it is in reality. But until then, it is a big moving deal because This is a wonderful reality that is really not being shown to kids who could benefit hugely from knowing, you know, if this is something that's true for them, that they have a future where they can be happy.
Rebecca Sugar is the creator of the Cartoon Network show Steven Universe. Rebecca, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
Listen to your heart, listen to the beat, listen to the rhythm of the street. Open up your eyes, open up your ears, get together and make things better by working together.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. We'll see you tomorrow.